Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. It's time to learn and improve your American English skills. Today we go back into the classroom with Jonathan Evans and Jill Robbins to talk about some very important parts of speech that you need to know. Then, after today's lesson, we will give you a chance to use what you have learned as we hear about tourism in Iran as restrictions against the country are eased. So, let's get to work. Here is part one.
From VOA, Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. In an earlier program, we talked about the relative pronouns who, that, and which. We promised to give you more details about how to use relative clauses. In this episode, we look at how the relative adverbs where, when, and why are used. Let's take a look at how relative adverbs work. An adverb is a word that describes a verb, an adjective, another adverb, or a sentence. It is often used to show time, manner and place, or degree. The relative pronouns where, when, and why act as adverbs when they join sentences or clauses. Take these two sentences.
This is a swimming pool. I used to swim in the pool.
Notice how you can put the sentences together with the word where. This is the pool where I used to swim.
Another way to say that is, this is the pool in which I used to swim. That is a formal way and usually only found in writing. We use the relative adverb where to show the place of an action. The relative adverb when tells about the time of an action. Let's look at an example from The Logical Song by the rock group Supertramp.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful. A miracle, oh, it was beautiful, magical. And then they showed me a world where I could be so dependable. Oh, clinical, oh, intellectual, cynical.
The singer says that life was wonderful when he was young. Later, he uses another adverb to show the world where he could be dependable. A more formal way to say that would be, they showed me a world in which I could be dependable.
We often want to tell the reason for an action. This week, President Obama visited Alaska and talked about melting ice. So much ice is melting in Alaska, he said, that sea levels are rising quickly. Here's how he put it.
The pace of melting is only getting faster. It's now twice what it was between 1950 and 2000. Twice as fast as it was just a little over a decade ago. And it's one of the reasons why sea levels rose by about 8 inches over the last century. And why are they projected to rise another 1 to 4 feet this century?
President Obama made one sentence from these two ideas.
Ice is melting very quickly. Sea levels rose about 8 inches in the last 100 years.
His speech has another clause with a relative adverb that combines these ideas.
Ice is melting very quickly. Scientists predict that sea levels will rise even more.
The words the reason or the reasons often appear before the relative adverb why, but sometimes they are left out, as in President Obama's speech.
And why are they projected to rise another 1 to 4 feet this century?
Are you ready to try some sentences on your own? Put together these sentences with relative adverbs.
The coffee house is in my neighborhood. He got a job in a coffee house.
Is your answer like this? The coffee house where he got a job is in my neighborhood. Here's another one.
I got home from work. I saw the dogs playing in the yard.
One way to put these ideas together is, I saw the dogs playing in the yard when I got home from work.
Finally, let's put these two sentences together.
The dogs frightened the cat. The cat ran up the tree.
Combine these ideas as, the dogs are the reason why the cat ran up the tree.
You will sometimes hear that instead of why after the word reason, as in,
the dogs are the reason that the cat ran up the tree.
We leave you with Earth, Wind, and Fire singing Reasons.
Ooh, baby, I can't find the reasons why my love, it won't disappear. Can't find the reasons why I love you. Hey, I love you.
For Voice of America Learning English Everyday Grammar, I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The United States and other countries plan to begin easing economic restrictions against Iran next year. The easing of sanctions is part of the deal between six world powers and Iran to limit its nuclear activities. Iranians hope that the end of travel restrictions will lead to more foreigners visiting the country. In London, travel agents say some people are already asking how they can visit Iran. Christopher Jones-Cruz reports.
Tour companies say very few non-Iranians have ever been to Iran. They describe the country as one of the unexplored jewels of the Middle East. They say the countryside is beautiful and its people friendly. Foreigners have stayed away from Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. In 2013, just 90,000 people from North America and European Union countries visited Iran. Mehrdad Konsari works at Iran's Organization for Economic Reconstruction and National Reconciliation.
The difficulties we've had in Iran has definitely hurt the tourist industry in the sense that people are afraid to go. But those people that ventured and, you know, overcame these considerations and visited Iran were never sorry.
The nuclear deal reached in July is already helping to ease travel restrictions. Johnny Bielby founded Wild Frontiers Travel, a British travel agency. He says the agreement has led to an increase in interest in Iran.
Two things have happened since the nuclear deal. First of all, the Foreign Office had changed their advice against travel to Iran, and that's made it much simpler for people to get insurance and that sort of thing. So the numbers have gone up again. We've had to put on three extra departures this year alone to cope with the demand for the autumn season to Iran.
British traveller Bugsy Heath-Brown is joining one of those tour groups.
We decided to get on one of the first trips that we could to get out there, see the sights, meet the people before the big rush of the rest of the world.
Iran says it hopes to have 20 million visitors a year by 2025. Mr. Konsari says those tourists could spend up to $30 billion.
Now that this outside face of Iran is beginning to change, that I think the tourism offers a great opportunity for the Iranian economy.
Tour operators in the West say getting permission from Iranian officials to enter the country is still difficult. Sanctions are still in place, limiting the ability of banks in Iran to operate outside the country. As a result, most payments have to be made in cash. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. Scientists in England are using two self-directed water vehicles to explore the animal and plant life of the Celtic Sea. The Celtic Sea is a body of water off the southern coast of Ireland. The area is known for its exceptional sea life. Scientists want to know why marine animals are so attracted to this part of the Atlantic Ocean. One of the research vehicles is powered by batteries. It collects information for the National Oceanographic Center in Southampton, England, and the World Wildlife Fund. The vehicle's low energy requirements permit it to stay afloat for up to 30 days. Reports of what it finds in the Celtic Sea are sent by satellite. Stephen Woodward is an engineer who helped design the craft. He says the vehicle has equipment that can detect small organisms called zooplankton and fish. He adds that other sensing devices measure water currents and other features of sea life. The vehicle also creates a two-dimensional map of the sea. Another vehicle is powered by solar panels and a wind turbine. It can stay afloat for months. The robotic vehicle sends information about the so-called biodiversity hotspots. A biodiversity hotspot is an area of an ocean that has a lot of plant and animal life activity. Lavinia Suberg is one of the scientists studying the biodiversity of the Celtic Sea. She says productive ocean areas, like the Celtic Sea, attract zooplankton. The zooplankton then attract fish. She adds that areas with a large increase of fish often attract sea mammals and birds. Using these robotic ocean vehicles greatly reduces the cost of exploring the seas with manned laboratories. Scientists can spend more time analyzing the collected information. They say the research will give them a better understanding of the needs of the Celtic Sea for future management and protection. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. For more technology stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. You can email comments to us at learningenglish@voanews.com. Give us a like on the VOA Learning English Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Learn English. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In October of 1859, a group of anti-slavery extremists attacked the town of Harper's Ferry. Harper's Ferry was part of Virginia then. Today, It is located in West Virginia. The attackers were led by John Brown. They seized a gun factory and a federal supply center where military equipment was kept. They planned to use the guns and equipment to organize a rebel army of slaves. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell us what happened to John Brown after he seized Harper's Ferry.
The President of the United States in 1859 was James Buchanan. When Buchanan learned of the attack, he wanted immediate action. He sent a force of Marines to Harper's Ferry under the command of Army Colonel Robert E. Lee. John Brown had attacked with about 20 men. Several, including two of his sons, had been killed by local militia. He and his remaining men withdrew to a small brick building. The attack had failed. Not one slave had come to Harper's Ferry to help Brown. The few whom his men had freed had refused to fight when the shooting started. Brown could not understand the fear that kept the slaves from fighting for their freedom.
Brown and his men were trapped inside the brick building. They held a few hostages, whom they hoped to exchange for their freedom. Colonel Lee wrote a message to John Brown, demanding his surrender. He did not think Brown would surrender peaceably, so he planned to attack as soon as Brown rejected the message. He felt this was the surest way to save the lives of the hostages. As expected, Brown refused to surrender. He said he and his men had the right to go free. As soon as Brown spoke, the signal was given. The Marines attacked. They broke open a small hole in the door of the brick building. One by one, the Marines moved through the hole. They fought hand to hand against the men inside. After a brief fight, they won. John Brown's rebellion was crushed.
A few hours after Brown was captured, the governor of Virginia and three congressmen arrived in Harper's Ferry. They wanted to question Brown. Brown had been wounded in the final attack. He was weak from the loss of blood, but he welcomed the chance to explain his actions. The officials first asked where Brown got the money to organize his raid. Brown said he raised most of it himself. He refused to give the names of any of his supporters. Then the officials asked why Brown had come to Harper's Ferry. "We came to free the slaves," Brown said, "and only that." He continued, "I think that you are guilty of a great wrong against God and humanity. I believe anyone would be perfectly right to interfere with you so far as to free those you wickedly hold in slavery. I think I did right. You had better, all you people of the South, prepare yourselves for a settlement sooner than you are prepared for it. You may get rid of me very easily. I am nearly gone now. But this question is still to be settled, this Negro question, I mean. That is not yet ended."
The raid on Harper's Ferry increased the bitterness of the national dispute over slavery. Members of the Democratic Party called the raid a plot by the Republican Party. Republican leaders denied the charge. They said the raid was the work of one man, one madman, John Brown. Still, they said, he had acted for good reason, to end slavery in America. Southern newspapers condemned Brown. Some said his raid was an act of war. Some demanded that he be executed as a thief and murderer. Many Southerners said all of the North was responsible for the raid. They believed all Northerners wanted a slave rebellion in the South. And it was such a rebellion that Southerners feared more than anything else. New measures were approved throughout the South to prevent this. Military law was declared in some areas. Slave owners threatened to beat or hang any Negro who even looked rebellious.
The fear of a slave rebellion united the people of the South. For years, rich slave owners had talked of taking the Southern states out of the Union to save their way of life. But those who had no slaves opposed the idea of disunion. John Brown's raid changed that. After his attack on Harper's Ferry, the South spoke with one voice. All Southerners declared that they would fight to protect their homes from a Negro rebellion or from another attack by men like Brown. Feelings were especially high in Virginia, the state in which the raid took place. Virginians wanted Brown punished quickly to show what would happen to anyone who tried to lead a Negro rebellion. There was some question whether Brown should be tried in a federal court or a state court. Brown's raid took place within the borders of a state, but the property he seized belonged to the federal government. The governor of Virginia decided to try Brown in a state court. He believed a federal court trial would take too long. If Brown were not brought to trial quickly, he said, people might attack the jail and kill him.
Brown was being held in Charlestown, a few kilometers from Harper's Ferry. The court there named two lawyers to defend him. A doctor examined Brown. He reported that Brown's wounds were not serious enough to prevent the trial from starting. Brown lay in a bed in the courtroom throughout the trial. John Brown's lawyers tried to show that his family had a history of madness. They tried to prove that Brown, too, was mad. They asked the court to declare him innocent because of insanity. Brown protested. He said the lawyers were just trying to save his life. He did not want such a defense. The matter of insanity was dropped.
Brown's lawyers then argued that he was not guilty of the three crimes with which he was charged. First, they said, he could not be guilty of treason against Virginia because he was not a citizen of Virginia. Second, he could not be guilty of plotting a slave rebellion because he had never incited slaves against their owners. And third, he could not be guilty of murder because he had killed only in self-defense. The trial lasted 5 days. The jury found John Brown guilty of all three charges.
The judge asked Brown if he wanted to make a statement before being sentenced. Brown did. He declared that he had not planned to start a slave rebellion. He said he only wanted to free some slaves and take them to Canada. Brown's statement was strong, but it was not true. He had, in fact, planned to organize an army of slaves to fight for their freedom. He acted in the belief that slaves throughout the South would rise up against their owners and join him. Brown's words did not move the judge. He said he could find no reason to question the jury's decision that Brown was guilty. He sentenced Brown to be hanged.
One of Brown's supporters attempted to find a way to free Brown from jail. Several plans were proposed. None were tried. Brown himself did not want to escape. He said he could do more to destroy slavery by hanging than by staying alive. John Brown was executed on December 2nd, 1859. His death created a wave of public emotion throughout the country. In the North, people mourned. One man wrote, "The events of the last month or two have done more to build Northern opposition to slavery than anything which has ever happened before, than all the anti-slavery pamphlets and books that have ever been written." In the South, people cheered, but their happiness at Brown's punishment was mixed with anger at those who honored him. As the nation prepared for a presidential election year, the South renewed its promise to defend slavery or leave the Union. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. Transcripts of our programs can be found along with MP3s, podcasts, and historical images at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.